You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of November 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Georgina Godwin.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll set the day's news agenda with Shashank Joshi of the Royal United Services Institute think tank here in London. Shashank, what are we looking at?
I thought we'd take a tour of the Middle East's hotspots. So we'd look at Syria. We'll look at the diplomacy behind Iran's nuclear talks coming up on Wednesday. And we would look at the changing revolution in Libya.
More from Shashank later. Also ahead, we'll bring you part two of our special interview with Judge Essa Musa, the man who helped dismantle apartheid in South Africa, who's now working with the world's Kurdish populations.
The general feeling among the Kurdish people that there were not adequate response to them calling for a ceasefire, and there's still a lot of unhappiness.
And before the end of the programme, we'll bring you part two of our series on purveyors of soft power around the world to coincide with Monocle's annual soft power survey. Today, we'll be in Canada to celebrate a company that moves the rest of the world, literally.
I think when you think of a country the size of Canada, you think of a country that's huge with amazing distances, and in many ways, that's why Bombardier is such a nice fit with Canada.
And before the end of the programme, we'll leaf through the day's British front pages. We'll also check in with two US artists who have gone to Hong Kong to reimagine what sculpture might be.
It's a packed show, and we hope to fit in some music too. So stay with us here on Midori House.
Let's start off with the headlines. Here's Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Toronto City Council has voted to remove most of Mayor Rob Ford's remaining powers. Amongst the items they voted on were a reduction in Mr. Ford's budget and the delegation of many of his powers to the deputy mayor. He's promised to fight the council's decision and has labelled the vote a coup d'etat. He's been under intense pressure to resign but has refused to step down despite acknowledging buying illegal drugs while serving as mayor and admitting smoking crack cocaine. I beg your pardon. Following the meeting, he presented the first edition of the TV show Ford Nation, which he co-hosts with his brother, and he condemned the council's decisions.
It's hypocrisy at its best, and I'm not proud of what I've done. It's very humiliating, but, you know, being fiscally responsible down at City Hall, and let's call a spade here, the majority of councillors down there are left-wing tax and spend socialists. That's what they are, and there's a handful of us that are fiscally responsible. And if I was one of them, as you know, there's some councillors down there that have been criminally charged. Nothing wrong with that. I haven't been charged.
Police in Paris remain on high alert as they continue to hunt the man who shot and critically wounded a photographer at the French daily newspaper Libération. The 27-year-old was hit twice in the chest and is in intensive care. The suspect fled after the attack, and photos released by the authorities show a man of between 5'6" and 5'8" tall, with greying hair and what's described as a European appearance. He's estimated to be between 35 and 45 years old. The gunman also opened fire in front of the Société Générale International Bank in western Paris. The Pentagon says Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has told the Turkish Foreign Minister that the United States will keep its two Patriot missile batteries in Turkey for up to another year. The statement followed a meeting in Washington and said the extension had been requested by Turkey. The expected decision follows backing last week by NATO allies for the extension, which helps bolster Turkish air defences as Syria's civil war rages. Indonesia's ambassador to Australia has been recalled for consultations following media reports that Australia's spy agencies had tried to tap mobile phones of top officials. The reports called the eavesdropping an unfriendly act that would damage ties. The call for the envoy to come home marks a new low in increasingly tetchy relations between the neighbours since Australia's Conservative Prime Minister Tony Abbott took office in September. He's refusing to comment.
It's in no one's interest to do anything or to say anything that would jeopardise that relationship, and certainly I'm not going to.
Larry Flint, the publisher of the porn magazine Hustler, who was shot and paralysed in 1978, has gone to court to object to the pending execution in Missouri of a convicted serial killer who fired the bullet that put him in a wheelchair. Flint opposes the death penalty and he wants Joseph Paul Franklin, who's been convicted of killing 8 people from the late 1970s to 1980 in racially motivated attacks, to spend the rest of his life in prison. Franklin, an avowed white supremacist, is due to be executed just after midnight on Wednesday, but Flint wants the execution to be called off.
They talk justice, but really what they want is vengeance. And that's not what our system should be about. It should be about justice. You put a man in a 3x6 cell for the rest of his life, that's a lot of punishment. But if you stuff out his life with a lethal injection in a few seconds, his punishment is over.
The pistol which the legendary Wild West lawman Wild Bill Hickok was carrying when he was shot dead in Deadwood in 1876 has failed to sell at auction in San Francisco. The highest bid for the Smith & Wesson No. 2 revolver was $200,000, but it had been valued at between $300,000 and $500,000. Hickok was playing poker in a saloon in Deadwood when he was shot in the back by Jack Crooked Nose McCall. The gun was one of the few possessions he left. His belongings were given to the owners of a stationery and tobacco store to settle his tab there. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much to Barney Burnham. It's 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House. We are live from Studio One and we are in Midori House in London. And it's time to set the day's news agenda, as we do at this point in the show. The three stories we'll be keeping our eye out for throughout the day. And helping us with that today, Shashank Joshi of Roosey here in London. Shashank, how are you?
Morning, very well, thanks.
Excellent. Where would you like to start for us today?
I thought we could go from least violent to most violent.
Okay.
And perhaps therefore begin with Iran, which is the slowest moving story. It's a diplomatic saga that's been going on for weeks. 10 days ago, we were gathered here discussing the first round of those dramatic Geneva negotiations, and now we're on the cusp of another round. And it's fascinating to see what's been going on in the interim. The US-Israel relationship has been progressively shredded by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's vocal condemnation of what he says is an exceptionally bad deal. And I find it interesting, you know, no matter how much Obama is pleading with him to accept this, that, look, it's only an interim deal, it's only 6 months, it's only very limited sanctions relief for Iran. They spoke for 90 minutes on the phone a few days ago, and Netanyahu is still coming out and raging against this. I also find it interesting, François Hollande, who is not doing so well at home, pretty bad in the polls, looking a bit down, is being feted as some sort of saviour of the Israeli people, you know, saviour of the Jews and shield against Iranian aggression in Israel for his stance in the nuclear negotiations. Where
that
he
really is a surprise, isn't it, given that people expected a sort of reversal or at least a stepping back from Sarko's stance.
Exactly,
previously.
Exactly. I mean, we thought it was Sarkozy who was behind France's tough non-proliferation position. Famously, Jacques Chirac in 2007, I think it was, said a nuclear Iran would be not very dangerous. And for all the people saying France is traditionally a strong actor against non-proliferation, well, this is the country that sold Iraq its Osirak reactor that Israel had to then bomb. So it's amazing to see how France is manoeuvring here, and it connects into wider geopolitical shifts, of course. I think you also have France currying favour with Saudi Arabia in a moment of opportunity when the French and the Saudis are working with each other on Syria. But I think what's really interesting is to see how this will play out tomorrow. Will we get an interim deal? And I think we probably will. I think it's gone too far to go back. Or will the French now be trapped by their own rhetoric and feel they have to take Israeli negotiating positions into the room in Geneva and push for an even harder deal?
Shashank, what about the National Council of Resistance, the NCR, the exiled opposition Iranian group, who are now saying that they can show that there's a new underground nuclear facility?
What a coincidence, isn't it, that they've just found a new nuclear site just a day before nuclear talks? It's almost as if they're trying to sabotage nuclear negotiations with a probably spurious story on a nuclear site for which there's almost no evidence of a nuclear military role. So this is in keeping with the NCRI's modus operandi. They did reveal the sites 10 years ago that precipitated the nuclear crisis, of course. Fordo and Natanz, the sites we all know and love as Iran's enrichment facilities. But they are a group of mostly nutters. They are formerly a terrorist group that were only delisted in the United States thanks to severe lobbying. I wouldn't take what they say too seriously. Most of it, they are mostly a conduit for leaks by intelligence services, some of which may have some value, others don't. In this particular case, I don't think that the charges have any merit.
Shashank, but before we go on to Syria, Karen Lee of the Syria Deeply website gave us her assessment of the battle for Syria a short while ago.
The revolution has really shifted. I think a couple of years ago it was the opposition versus Assad, and now it's really the opposition fighting extremist groups. And Assad, in many people's eyes, has almost become this afterthought. You have the extremist groups, which are ISIS and to an extent Jabhat al-Nusra, and they're trying to take over any of the land held by the moderates, which would be the Free Syrian Army, the original opposition. And, you know, I mean, the infighting is kind of the story these days. These groups, there's all these different ideologies coming out now. There's foreign fighters pouring into Syria. It's really become this jihadist battleground. And you've got so many clashes between rebel groups, it's almost hard to keep track of them now. And that's really, really hurting the opposition going forward, because all their resources now are going into fighting extremists instead of going into fighting the government.
Shashank, what's your take on that?
I think it's a very, very concise summation of where the revolution is. And I thought what we discussed today is something that sums that up, which is the death of a key rebel commander, a chap called Abdul Qader al-Saleh, a 33-year-old, who headed up something called the Tawhid Brigade, which means the Unity Brigade. It was a collection of some umbrella group. It was a coalition of smaller brigades in the north of Syria who united. They were a key force early in the conflict, but then they were squeezed out of their key areas by the groups that were just mentioned, the jihadists like ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, and it's interesting to see how they reacted. With the death of al-Saleh, he was on the one hand admired for what he did. On the other hand, you can see this real concern among moderate rebels that he made too many accommodations just to survive with those same hardline Islamists. He allowed the Free Syrian Army, which of course is the so-called moderate group, the Western-backed group that is the military arm of the Syrian National Coalition in some ways, to be driven out by the jihadists. He stood by, protecting his own interests. He insisted he was fighting for all Syrians, but over time he began to talk about how they were fighting for the Sunnis. In other words, a sectarian shift in his own rhetoric. And I think he's a great example of a commander who initially stood in that place between the total seculars, the defectors from the Syrian army, and the Islamists, but then slowly blurred into the Islamist category just to survive. And it's a mark of the shift of the entire rebellion and just why it is in such an awful, awful place today.
And where does that leave those from the outside of Syria's borders who are striving to get various bodies around a table so that progress can be made? I mean,
It leaves him in despair, head in hands, weeping, wishing they had never even spoken the terms Geneva II, because even the most moderate of groups, the most Western-backed of groups, the Syrian National Coalition, with its all its little component parts, and, you know, Monty Python, People's Front of Judea versus Judean People's Front, little squabbles within it, has said it's not quite sure whether it wants to attend the peace conference, and it says it doesn't like the conditions, let alone groups like the Tawhid Brigade, who would think coming to Geneva II would be a betrayal and a pointless exercise.
Let's talk about Libya before you go, Shashank. I mean, the development of the sort of Misrata militiamen has become something that's clearly the government is struggling to find stability around. What's the latest here?
Well, the latest is Misrata, which is a coastal town besieged by Colonel Gaddafi, important in the revolution, then parked its militia forces in Tripoli after the war finished, was involved in a huge standoff over the weekend in which many, many people were killed who were protesting against the militia. They say they've now withdrawn, but the latest twist in the story is if the Prime Minister can be kidnapped in Libya, no one's safe. And rest assured, the Deputy Intelligence Chief was picked up from an airport parking lot in Tripoli and simply seized.
Mustafa, got in the wrong cab by the sounds of things.
There are lots of wrong cabs in Tripoli these days. And he himself was from Misrata, so perhaps that was the motivation. But I think, you know, this is just another sign that if even the Deputy Intelligence Chief and the Prime Minister cannot stop themselves from being picked up at the will of some militia or some armed faction, how are we ever going to have enduring security in Libya?
And I mean, this comes as Tripoli's observing their general strike in protest against the presence of militia groups in the city.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a sense in Libya that the mood is changing, fundamentally changing. We've had anti-militia protests before. We had them after the fatal attack on Ambassador Christopher Stevens in the compound in Benghazi last year. But now I think this is serious. People are really angry with militias who they see as having caused needless violence, firing anti-aircraft guns into crowds. The mood is changing, but ultimately they have the guns. The government doesn't have more guns than the militias. This is these are militias with a state, not a state with some militias in it. And so this is a real problem for the government.
Shashank, thank you very much indeed. That's Shashank Joshi of the Royal United Services Institute think tank here in London. As ever, thank you for coming in to join us here on Monocle 24.
Coming up after this short break, we will bring you part two of our special interview with Judge Essa Musa. That's right after this short break.
They are the eyes and the ears that follow the most powerful politician in the world.
Good afternoon, everybody. I am eager to take your questions.
They're the witnesses to some of the most pivotal moments in U.S. history.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Today, our nation saw evil, the very worst of human nature, and we responded with the best of America.
It's been a long time coming, but tonight, because of what we did on this day, in this election, at this defining moment, change has come to America.
All this week on The Globalist and The Globalist Asia, we meet the members of the White House press pool, the reporters who cover events from the center of political life in the U.S., and who get closer than anyone else to the commander-in-chief. We'll hear from those who saw presidents rise.
President Bush came to office with a simple set of policy goals, chief among them a reduction in taxes. He achieved that relatively quickly, to everyone's surprise.
And who saw presidents fall.
The Lewinsky story was a little different. Bill Clinton had signed a law making it much easier to bring these kinds of actions. So he was sort of caught up in his own problems of his making.
From a vantage point at the heart of the White House, that's Tales from the White House Press Pool, a series of special reports, all this week on Monocle 24.
Yes, this is Midori House, and you are listening to Monocle 24. Now, on yesterday's programme, we brought you part one of a special interview with Judge Essa Musa. He is the judge, of course, who played a pivotal role in dismantling the framework of apartheid in South Africa.
Well, today, Judge Essa Musa is one of the key supporters of the world's Kurdish minorities, working with others to resolve the so-called Kurdish question.
Yes, the area, loosely known as Kurdistan, covers regions in four countries: Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Turkey. And there are some 30 million people who would count themselves as Kurds. But however strong the sense of a Kurdish identity might be, the feeling among many is that this is a people without a home. The Kurds in northern Iraq do enjoy partial autonomy, and Turkey's push towards the EU has brought some benefits to Kurdish minorities there.
But discrimination still exists, and the frustration of being a people with a collective identity but with no state to accompany it continues. Judge Musa spoke to Monocle's Ala John on the ongoing fight for a Kurdish state.
I got involved with the Kurdish question in 1997 when a group of Kurdish activists came to South Africa and they were seeking a place for their leader, Abdullah Öcalan, who was then at the time banned in Turkey. The organization that he led, the PKK, was also banned. He then fled to the Middle East. There was a lot of pressure by the Turkish government on the Middle Eastern countries, and he had to leave the Middle Eastern countries. When he landed up in Europe, thinking that he would be able to get political asylum in one of the countries in Europe. And because of pressure from Turkey, all the countries, in fact, refused. And that is how they came to South Africa to seek political asylum. We approached the Nelson Mandela government. The government agreed to give him political asylum, provided he finds himself on the South African soil. And it was when he left Europe on his way to South Africa when he was intercepted in Kenya and handed over to the Turkish authority. They then charged him for treason. He was then sentenced to death. But because Turkey was trying to get into the European Union, one of the conditions of their admission to the European Union was that they must abolish the death penalty. They did abolish the death penalty, and that's how his sentence was converted to life imprisonment. He's still presently serving his sentence on an island, similar to Robben Island, where Mandela served his sentence. And he's been on the island also for about 14 years.
That's a very explicit similarity.
Yeah.
There are obviously other similarities you may draw between the Kurdish people, be they in Iran or Iraq or, or Syria or Turkey, and the black peoples of South Africa during apartheid. Mm. Was it that similarity that drew you to the work?
Well, because of the fact that I was fairly active in two things, in the political transformation of South Africa from apartheid democracy, and I was also a lawyer by profession, having defended quite a number of people. And I had close contact with the Mandela government at the time. They approached me to make the necessary opening for Abdullah Öcalan to get political asylum. And that's how I got involved with the Kurdish issue, because what then happened was we then formed a welcoming committee in order to receive him. If we had landed, then we would have then facilitated his application for political asylum. After he was in, arrested, handed over to the Turkish authority, we decided to convert that committee into the Kurdish Human Rights Action Group. I became the chairman of that, and that organization has existed since then. Its objective was essentially to monitor the human rights abuses of the Kurdish people in Turkey and also to monitor the conditions of imprisonment of Abdullah Öcalan.
Whether they be from whichever country which Kurdistan straddles, it involves people from who occupy nationalities from different countries.
Yeah.
That process of dialogue that you have to strike up to ascertain some kind of middle ground, that must be incredibly complicated when you're dealing with, in fact, four host nations rather than just Turkey. They could come from Turkey. They could come from northern Iraq. They could come from Syria or Iran.
Well, initially, because of the activists that came to see me from, they were from Turkey, we actually concentrated on the human rights violation in Turkey. But as things evolved, there were also human rights violations in Syria. And we then obviously got involved in that situation as well, and obviously in Iran. And that's how we then broaden our scope and objective to include the other countries.
Looking at Turkey's accession to the EU, has that played a positive role in them upholding the criteria which they need to uphold to be able to join the EU and the Kurdish question? Has that helped the plight of the Kurdish people?
To some extent, it has helped. For example, when I referred to the death penalty, which they abolished, was because of one of the criteria for admission. But they've been very slow in meeting the international criteria on human rights, particularly over the last few years. There have been a number of arrests of lawyers who've actually been performing their duty as lawyers, but they've somehow been connected with political crimes in which they actually defended their accused people. They've also charged a journalist who they claim aided and abetted terrorism, when in fact they were reporting on the situation in Turkey. And they've received quite lengthy sentences in respect of those charges of which they were convicted.
Despite that, there has been some progress towards the reconciliation of the Kurdish people in Turkey.
Yeah, for example, if I must mention some progress, the Kurdish people decided to suspend the armed struggle.
Öcalan called for a ceasefire on the 21st of March 2013.
Absolutely, that's correct. And what has happened, they now expected the government, the Turkish government, to make necessary concessions. They made certain concessions. For example, they allowed the Kurdish language to be spoken freely and openly without criminalizing anyone speaking the language. They've allowed them to teach the Kurdish language, but privately, not publicly.
They've reduced the threshold.
They've reduced the
for
threshold.
Political parties.
Yeah, that was one of the demands of the Kurdish people. But you, on the other hand, you found still a lot of the political activists of the Kurdish in prison. And not only that, there were a lot of the charges that I mentioned relating to journalists and lawyers who defended the Kurdish activists. They're still in prison. And I think the general feeling among the Kurdish people that there were not adequate response to them calling for a ceasefire. And there's still a lot of unhappiness. And I think that they haven't gone far enough to at least show some good faith to say, look, they're prepared to move along the peace process by showing that they're also making important concessions in that regard.
There was some discussion around the time of the protests in Turkey back in May and June of this year that the focus had been taken away from the Kurdish dilemma. And in fact, it had been the way Erdogan's administration dealt with the protests took away the focus from from the Kurdish question, and there was some dismay that it may have irrevocably taken away that focus.
Yeah.
The focus is back to an extent, but do you feel that anticipation of a positive outcome that you may have felt during apartheid or the end of apartheid? Mm.
Well, I mean, in 2007, I was in Turkey. I was monitoring the local government elections, and at that point in time, there were a lot of interest from the different political parties that they wanted to solve the Kurdish issue. And I, at least, was hopeful that after the elections, things would improve and they would find a political solution to the Kurdish issue. Unfortunately, it did not happen. In fact, they arrested a number of Kurdish activists after that. And some of them are still imprisoned at this point in time.
That was Judge Essa Musa. He was speaking to our own Alid John here at Midori House. You're listening to Monocle 24.
Well, it's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we head to Madrid and our man in the Spanish capital, Liam Alders. Liam, thanks for joining us. I'm guessing that you're breathing a whole lot easier now.
Yes, as are the rest of the Madrileños, because as it's been widely reported, the garbage strike that's paralyzed the capital for the last 2 weeks is finally over. It came to an end on Sunday, and the workers actually seem to have achieved most of their demands. Their salaries won't be cut. They have a salary freeze for the next 4 years, and all of the redundancies that were planned, the 1,300 redundancies, won't be happening anymore. So they're breathing easy, but it's the mayor who seems to have come out most tarnished.
It does seem very damaging for Botella. Now she's the wife of the former prime minister. She's been accused of all sorts of things for being very callous and giving condolences to the when that awful incident where the five teenagers died and then going off on a spa break. She's seen as quite a callous person, isn't she?
That's definitely one word that she's been described as. But the problem is that she lacks credibility because she was never voted in. She actually inherited the job after the former mayor was moved to the national ministry. So she lacks credibility, and because she is the wife of the ex-prime minister, who is loathed by at least half of the population, she's also quite a controversial figure, and therefore there's a lot for her to prove that she's actually able to do the job job well, but the latest scandal in which she basically washed her hands of the strike at the beginning, saying that it was basically a labor dispute between the private company and some workers, and then as the garbage mounted, suddenly just last weekend announced that she would be launching a private army of 200 workers to actually remove 600 tons of rubbish from the streets. And she came out on the streets at 4 in the morning wearing this lavish fur coat, which was derided in the media and also on social media, because she just seemed to reinforce the image that she was out of touch. She came just basically pointing fingers and smiling, surrounded by about 30 police bodyguards. So later, on Sunday night, when the strike was declared over, she came out saying that it had nothing to do with the strike. It was actually the new workers or the new labor industrial relations legislation that led to this result. But then contradicted herself by saying that a new law is needed to regulate strikes. So once again, she's causing a lot of controversy.
Liam, so slightly clearer air in Madrid. Over in Valencia, someone's vanished into thin air. This is how you avoid a corruption trial, apparently. Who is it?
Yes, it's the also very controversial Francisco Camps, who actually stepped down in 2011 after being indicted in a graft inquiry. He's actually involved. He's been called to testify in a very, very high-profile corruption scandal involving the king's son-in-law, who is under investigation on trial for siphoning off 6 million euros of public funds with his business partner. And Francisco Camps was called to testify over the weekend, but he just disappeared. The police went to, they called him. Apparently a phone was provided to him by the judge to call him up when it was his turn to testify. He didn't answer the phone. The police went around on four separate occasions. He was nowhere to be found, even at his house. And basically on Monday turned up to say, no, I was home the whole time. I don't know what you're talking about. And so people are suggesting that he's trying to invoke his right to testify through a written statement, which is actually a right of his as a former premier. So the judge has actually called him to testify again. We'll see if he actually takes the stand, though.
Liam Aldous, our man in Madrid. That's all we got time for. Thanks, as ever, for joining us on Midori House.
In the next half an hour of the programme, we'll discuss the arts in Hong Kong, leaf through the day's British front pages, and we'll bring you part two of our Soft Power series to coincide with Monocle's annual Soft Power survey. Today, we hear from Canadian manufacturer Bombardier.
But first, here's Barney Burnham. He's got the headlines.
Thanks, Dom. Toronto City Council has voted to remove most of Mayor Rob Ford's remaining powers. They voted to reduce his budget and to delegate many of his powers to the deputy mayor. He has labelled the vote a coup d'etat. Police in Paris remain on high alert as they continue to hunt the man who shot and critically wounded a photographer at the French daily newspaper Libération. The 27-year-old was hit twice in the chest and is in intensive care. The Pentagon says Defence Secretary Chuck Hagel has told the Turkish Foreign Minister that the United States will keep its two Patriot missile batteries in Turkey for up to another year. The statement followed their meeting in Washington and said that the extension had been requested by Turkey. Indonesia's ambassador to Australia has been recalled for consultations following media reports that Australian spy agencies had tried to tap mobile phones of top officials. The reports called the eavesdropping an unfriendly act that would damage ties. Larry Flint, the publisher of the porn magazine Hustler, who was shot and paralysed in 1978, has gone to court to object to the pending execution in Missouri of a convicted serial killer who fired the bullet that put him in a wheelchair. And the pistol which the legendary Wild West lawman Wild Big Bill Hickok was carrying when he was shot dead in Deadwood in 1876 by Jack Crooked Nose McCall has failed to sell at auction in San Francisco. The highest bid for the revolver was $200,000, but it had been valued at between $300,000 and $500,000. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Jack Crooked-Nosed McCall. I mean,
he'd obviously had his nose put out of joint.
Nice. You see, I like that. You thought about that. I mean, don't you think we should bring back that Western tradition of giving people nicknames in between their first and surname? You know, I think you could be...
During the Cray Twins time, you know, Jack the Hat McVitie was one of their victims.
This is it. It's descriptive, isn't it?
Mad Frankie Fraser. He was another one, wasn't he? Diamond Geezer.
I'm going to call you...
Barney Nice Jumper Burnham today, if that's okay with you. Thanks, Barney.
It's 10:34 in Beirut, 8:34 here in London and 3:34 in Montreal. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin and Dominic Reynolds. Now, in this week's series, we'll be taking a look at soft power superstars around the world to coincide with Monocle's annual soft power survey. Nations are increasingly trying to get what they want through attraction rather than coercion, looking beyond military might to exert a more nuanced influence on the world stage. Well-known figures and brands serve as one means of garnering global attention.
Well, today we're in Canada to celebrate a company that moves the rest of the world. Montreal-based Bombardier is the world's only manufacturer of planes and trains. Despite recent financial difficulties, the company still represents a positive image of Canada on the global stage. Well, a little earlier, Tom Edwards spoke to David Soberman, Canadian National Chair in Strategic Marketing at the University of Toronto. Tom began by asking why Bombardier is an effective soft power tool for Canada.
One of the ways I would answer that is to not just necessarily think of recent performance, but to think of how the company has performed over the last 5, 10, 15, even 20 years. And when you think of it that way, it's a company which has had very visible impact in a number of categories that people all across the world see, namely trains, automobiles, and certainly in northern country, snowmobiles and snow machines.
And tell us a little bit about why it does reflect the positive aspects, if you like, of Canada and Canadian industry. Is it because it's a family-run company? Is it because it does things the right way? What are the actual qualities that make it stand out, do you think?
I think that probably the number one reason that it stands out is because I think when you think of a country the size of Canada, you think of a country that's huge with amazing distances, and in many ways, that's why Bombardier is such a nice fit with Canada, because clearly one of the big challenges we have is getting from one place to another. I mean, if you live in a place like Singapore, which is a very small country, it's not nearly as much of a challenge as it is in Canada. And in that regard, Bombardier adds a lot of value to Canada, and so you get a lot of synergy between the country and the company.
And let's talk a little bit about then what Bombardier perhaps can teach the rest of the world about Canada, and maybe can also teach the rest of Canada. Do you think it's obviously a Montreal-based, but do you think that, you know, there are a lot of positive messages that can be learned throughout the whole country about the way Bombardier does business?
Yes, I actually think one of the important things to point out is that when you start talking about image, it's actually a two-way street. So it is true that in many ways, Bombardier does a service for Canada in the sense that it shows that we're actually pretty good at making pretty complicated, pretty technical products, and they're pretty reliable, and people all over the world have faith in them. But it also goes the other way, which is that Bombardier capitalizes to a large extent on the image of Canada. And Canada, outside of our own borders, we actually have a pretty positive image because we have the sort of image of being a country with lots of natural beauty, a country where people are sort of diplomatic and relatively friendly and welcoming. And when you actually put that into the context of a brand image, it adds a lot. So I think Bombardier gains from Canada just like Canada gains from Bombardier. And I think that's one of the things that perhaps contributes to their success.
And David, I'd just like to get your, you know, a broader perspective on sort of soft power and the effectiveness with which Canada works in that sort of environment. So there are some industrial successes, undoubtedly. How do you rate the performance of Canada generally? Do you think there's things that the country could do better in terms of harnessing its soft power? Because there are a lot of incredible assets that Canada has. Does it milk them as effectively as perhaps it could?
Well, I think that obviously there's an interesting aspect of that. First of all, we're not going to be a country that's ever going to exert our influence through what I would call hard power, simply because from a political and from a military point of view, we're not really one of the world's leading countries. So basically, the only way we have to sort of influence the world is through our soft power. And I think one of the big things that has always acted as a barrier to Canada perhaps exerting more power, power that might be in fact in keeping with, let's call it, the degree of innovation and the degree of experience and the degree of skill we have in our country, is we tend to be relatively risk averse. And this is probably in relation to the Americans and also in relation to a number of Asian countries. And this means that when you don't take risks and you don't dream big, it's much harder to be big. It's much harder to actually have those real home runs, as we call them in Canada. And I think this is something that we're starting to learn. As the world globalizes, if we want to have global companies, part of becoming a global company means that you have to be willing to take risks. You have to be willing to lose in order to win. I mean, this is something which the Americans have always had it as part of their psyche, part of their sort of corporate mantra is taking risks. And it's something that we probably have to think more about as Canadians.
That was David Soberman, Canadian National Chair in Strategic Marketing at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto, no less, and he was talking to our news editor, Tom Edwards.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a check-in with the Hong Kong arts world.
The Monocle Book Tour has touched down in the warmer parts of the globe, and this November we'll be packing the snowshoes and chilling out in the Nordic region. Starting on November the 18th in Stockholm and taking in a different country each day, we'll be shooting through Oslo and Copenhagen before ending up in Helsinki on the 21st, and we'll be bringing you live shows right here on Monocle 24 from each stop along the way. So if you want to hear how the Monocle Guide to Better Living is going down in the snowier parts of Europe, point your mouse towards book.monocle.com and be sure to tune in to Nordic Leg of the Monocle Book Tour this November on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:40 here in London. Now, in Hong Kong, in a few days' time, two artists are making their debut in the region with two challenging shows. Daniel Arsham and Kaz Oshiro represent the East and West Coasts of the United States, respectively. And their work, which plays with the borders of sculpture, is set to ruffle feathers on the Hong Kong art scene.
I'm pleased to say that both artists join us now from our Hong Kong bureau. First, we're going to speak to Daniel. Daniel Arsham, welcome to the programme. Very pleased you can join us from our bureau in Hong Kong. It's a bit tough doing art on the radio, isn't it? Like dancing about architecture. It's a difficult one. But for those who haven't got the visual aid of your work in front of them, try and give us an idea of the sort of concerns you have.
Sure. Much of my work is about the kind of alteration of things that people already know, that they may have a kind of expectation about. So architecture is something very present within my work, and there are a number of pieces in this exhibition that actually where I've manipulated the physical surface of the architecture. So if you can imagine, you know, in your mind, a figure walks up to the edge of a wall and lifts the edge over themselves, concealing themselves behind the surface of the wall. This is one of the kind of gestures that's created in this exhibition.
Now, you've collaborated with a variety of different creative people in lots of different fields. I mean, you've been involved with dance, with fashion, in creating fitting rooms for Dior Homme. Tell me about that.
My practice, you know, has always been in many ways about collaboration. I worked for many years as a stage designer for the choreographer Merce Cunningham. And for him, you know, his work was very collaborative in a sense, but it was also sort of about recognizing other artists' talents and that he could sort of adapt them for the expansion of his own practice. So I've sort of adapted, you know, his mode of working, and in many ways I will collaborate with architects and choreographers and other artists in the kind of overall gesture of my practice.
I mean, so much of your work, Daniel, is about, as you've been explaining, the sort of clash of media, of worlds and borders and the places where they overlap. You're overlapping the world of US art with the Hong Kong scene now. How do you feel about starting out your first show in Hong Kong?
You know, I've been traveling. I actually did an interview with Monocle in London last month during Freeze. So it's been this kind of world tour. And, you know, continually as I'm traveling, in some ways, the world feels actually smaller to me. You know, every place that I go, there are people that I've seen in other cities. And I think that the art world, you know, Hong Kong is now a kind of major art capital with Art Basel moving here. And it's everything in some ways is growing and starting to feel more like the same thing.
And in terms of a market there, is there a lot of art changing hands in Hong Kong?
That's what the gallerist is for. You know, my job is sort of to come here and present my work. And obviously there, with Hong Kong Art Basel moving here, there must be this capital behind it. But it's really reserved for the gallery to work through this.
You've been on a world tour, virtually, as you explained there, and you've taken in so many different parts of the world. I wonder how that's likely to affect your work in future. What have you drawn from your experiences going around the world with your work?
You know, I just came from Japan before this trip and was able to visit some pieces on Naoshima Island, which are, is an island that has these permanent pieces installed. And I think that travel for me and seeing architecture, especially in different parts of the world, is something that is continually influencing the kind of sculpture that I make, the things that I'm looking at, what I'm paying attention to. Absolutely.
And where will you go next?
Well, this exhibition opens tomorrow night in Hong Kong, and then I head back to New York before going to Miami for another edition of Art Basel. And I will be premiering a new film that I've been working on for the last year in Miami.
Daniel, thanks very much indeed. Well, as he was saying there, Don, it's up to the gallerist to say exactly how the art market moves. And this particular gallerist is
very, very interested, aren't you? Yeah,
I am. Emmanuel Perrotin. Now, one of the reasons I'm interested in is that I heard he had a hell of a party in New York last month. There was a really kind of bizarre circus-themed launch of his gallery there. He's a Frenchman, 45 years old, started as an art dealer at 21. One of the reasons that I'm interested in him is that he was one of the first people to take Damien Hirst seriously. And when he was just 21, he actually put Hirst's paintings on the top of his mother's car and took them off and gave Hirst one of his very first shows. So I thought that he's a pretty interesting man. Obviously a gallery in France, one in New York, and now here he is showing in Hong Kong. And one of the people, as well as Daniel Arsham, that he's showing is Kaz Oshiro, who's on the line now. Hi, Kaz.
Hello.
Tell us about your new works that you're showing in Hong Kong.
Yes, this is my first show in Hong Kong at Perrotin Gallery, and this show is more like introduction of my work from the past and present.
Well, introduce it to us if you could. I know it's a difficult thing, but try and describe for listeners, not viewers, what we could see.
Okay. For this exhibition, I have filing cabinets, Marshall amplifiers, Marshall speaker cabinets, and some wall paintings that look like, the broken paintings, I call it. It's more like a little bit of everything from the,
So, Kaz, what I understand is that you take everyday objects and you show them, but in fact they're not the real thing. So you'll take something like the bumper of a car and we'll look at it and think, oh, it's the bumper of a car, but in fact it's something you've created out of sculpture and out of paint.
Right. I use the same technique as other painters do. Make a wood frame and a stretch canvas over it and a paint. So I don't use any found object I build everything from scratch with the painter's tool.
But it looks as if it is absolutely a found object. I'm particularly interested in the way that you exhibit pieces that would normally be used for transmitting sound. So you have banks of speakers, for instance, but obviously in complete silence.
Right. Fortunately or unfortunately, they don't have any function as a real object. It's an artwork.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's the point you're making, is that here are these forms that should be functional, which in this instance don't make any sound at all. The Andy Warhol statement, I don't want it to be essentially the same, but exactly the same. You've kind of turned on your head. You're saying the same, but different.
That's right. Like Andy Warhol's Brillo box. Just like that. So I'll say, you know, my work is like offspring of what Andy Warhol did with his Brillo box.
Kaz, before you go, tell us when and where we can catch this exhibition.
Tomorrow night, the exhibition opens tomorrow night at Pedotown. Of course, Daniel Arsham show, it's like double show, so check it out.
Well, those in the area, I'm sure, will be coming by. Kaz Oshiro, and before him, Daniel Arsham. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on the line from our bureau in Hong Kong. And we will have some music. Should we have some music, Georgina?
I think we should have some music. You know, this is an artist, actually, that I've been playing quite a lot during the Continental Shift. She's great. She's a British girl. Although her song is would beg to differ, she has been discovered recently. This is called, it's Laura Welsh, it's called Undiscovered. You're the only one that I've got, but I can't get.
The recently discovered Laura Welsh with her hopelessly outdated song Undiscovered.
That was Laura Welsh. Thank you very much. So I wish you would come on the Continental Shift. You know, you're a gift to broadcasting in terms of announcing songs.
I couldn't unseat you, Georgina. Certainly not. Should we do some front pages then?
I think we should. We are here with our news editor, and it's time to leaf through the British front pages with Tom Edwards.
Hi, Georgina. Hi, Dom. How are you both today?
Hello. Very good, thanks. Nice to see you. With just sort of barely poking your head over a massive pile of newspapers, British papers.
It's significant, isn't it? It's a significant pile. I like to delve in.
What's at the top of your pile?
It's a treasure trove. Okay. I've actually got the Independent newspaper here. And you were talking about art in Hong Kong, so I thought I'd talk a little bit about art in Britain, mm-hmm. briefly.
Please.
Elegant link there.
That's good.
But it's bad news, Georgina and Dom, dear. I'm afraid. Lost by the nation. Britain is selling more art than ever before. And we used to have this cultural safety net here in the UK to stop the most valued, the most precious and significant, mm-hmm. culturally important works of art from disappearing from public view. Not anymore.
Who's selling them?
Well, the problem is, Dom, people relied traditionally on government support and philanthropic support,
yes.
both of which are drying up somewhat. Yeah, I don't know whether this is just post-2008. In the last 2 years... less than a third of the antiques, paintings, manuscripts that the Reviewing Committee on the Export of Works of Arts and Objects of Cultural Interest recommended should be saved did actually remain in the country. So that's a pretty alarming trend, I would say.
People do jump in. I mean, I know that Jane Austen's ring was saved for the nation. We've had various other ones. There were those couple
of... Kelly Clarkson was going to buy it and take it to America. That's terrible.
But fate worse than her death, which occurred some time ago for
exactly.
Jane Austen.
Exactly.
But there are those George Stubbs paintings, for instance. There's, I think, one of a wallaby and one of a kangaroo, which
that's right. Yeah, the National Maritime Museum paid £1.5 million to buy George Stubbs's Konguro from New Holland earlier this month.
Nice.
The problem, I think, comes when it's even more high-profile works, particularly not always by British artists. Now, you might think, oh, well, it's less important, but of course the wider cultural impact of those and the role they have in collections is still very significant. Pablo Picasso's Child with a Dove.
Yes.
Just show you that. Beautiful. £50 million gone.
Out of the window. I mean, I wonder if it means this government in the UK is going to get a rep, particularly with, if you look at that in parallel with what's happened to its support of British film, for example, funding cuts to the Film Council, whether or not it's going to get a difficult reputation for not being the supporter of the arts.
Absolutely, Dom. And I think what's interesting, particularly if you look at some sort of, you know, emerging economies, emerging markets, the emphasis they're putting, the support they're giving to cultural wealth and the collective importance of that. Look at, you know, in Qatar, in Dubai, billions being invested into museums, art, growing collections. It's almost as if we've lost sight of the necessary value. It's not purely economic. There's a broader cultural value that perhaps we're turning our backs on.
And for those countries, I mean, I think that they possibly think in the long run they're underpinning the economies of their countries by creating these vast new museums with treasures from the rest of the world.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not just a sort of cultural grandstanding. I think there's
was a serious kind of economic accumulation happening, and Britain shouldn't miss the boat, in my view.
Okay, well, I hope they're listening to you, Tom. And what else have you got for us?
Well, let me just talk briefly about
animals. Can it be an animal?
No. Give me a moment, Georgina. Let's talk about words first.
Georgina has partially become an animal in her excitement.
Even the most sentient of animals, even the great apes, don't quite have a full form of language yet. We do, though.
Yes.
And as journalists, I think we're all fascinated by words of the ear, aren't we?
We like them.
Any particular favourites? I gather we've mentioned one briefly already.
Everyone's talking about selfie. I find selfie...
Okay, I'd like you both to look at me and smile, because this is a selfie
Georgina,
with us all in
just
it.
Just so you know, if you're taking one of us, it's not a selfie.
You have to be in it. Live selfie action. But that's selfie...
Georgina does need the dictionary definition of selfie, it seems.
We should say it's being considered for inclusion in the Oxford English Dictionary. It's not there yet. To be nominated for Word of the Year,
I see.
Of course.
It's not there.
A word doesn't have to have been coined in the past 12 months, but it must have seen a significant increase in its popularity.
Explosion
and
in
notability.
Usage.
That's right. Some other, do you want a couple of other quick
comments? Yeah, that's very
briefly. Bedroom tax, of course. Binge watch.
This is confusing.
I literally don't know what that is.
A binge watch?
Yeah.
Is that some sort of irresponsible
dietary thing.
Timepiece that drinks too much?
Who knows, Dom? And I know, Dom, you'll particularly be disappointed. Twerk, not eligible yet.
Really?
I know.
But I've done so much to try and include it. Miley and I'd say, are its big proponents.
But you had a new word today, moves, Dom, didn't you?
What was my new word?
Slime bags or something.
What's off air is off air.
We're almost out of time. Let me just say one quick thing. Apes, apparently, according to the Daily Telegraph here in London, know what plants to eat to cure sickness. There's a bonobo. Look at him. Dr. Bonobo to you.
Dr. B.
That's right.
There he is. He looks very wise. I've always thought the bonobo the wisest looking of
Well, if cuts in this country continue, he'll probably be treating you at your local hospital soon, Dom.
Walk-in centre with Dr. B. Can't wait.
Now, listen, before you both go, we've got to pose for this selfie. But right now, this is all we've got time for today.
Thanks to our producer, Thomas Lewis, our researchers, Barbara Feeney, Fernando Pacheco and Rosie Sells, and our studio manager today, who was, of course, Mr. Alex Funnell. The Entrepreneurs is next after the news, and stay tuned for the briefing too. That's at 12 o'clock in London, 7 o'clock a.m. in New York City. Cordelia Lynch will be joining Georgina, I should say, with Midori House at exactly the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Dominic Reynolds.
And from me, Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. It's dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time. It tells history. Rolex.